This is what we call the Gog and Magog invasion. And I've seen those terms used in science fiction movies, and I've seen it used in super-duper cartoons, you know, with superheroes. This is a very common terminology here. But we'll look at this in just about the same detail we did maybe seven years ago, I think it was, when we did this the last time. And I'm going to just take the first 9 verses today, but because of the way that I'm going to divide this up, and I'm going to be bouncing around a little bit because I'm trying to make some divisions here to make this a little more understandable. So bear with me, and I'll answer any questions, obviously, as soon as we're done to make this a little more clear. But we're going to be in this these 2 chapters here for several weeks, trying to understand the entire prophecy, which has great import to world political events. So the first 9 verses of Ezekiel 38 read, "And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face towards Gog," or against Gog, "of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and I will turn thee about and put hooks in thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in full armor, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them handling swords, Persia, Cush, and Put, with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his hordes, the house of Togarma, in the uttermost parts of the north, and all his hordes, even many peoples with thee. Be thou prepared, yea, prepare thyself, thou and all thy companies that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. After many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. Thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, that is gathered out of many peoples upon the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste, but it is brought forth out of the peoples, and they shall dwell securely, all of them. And thou shalt ascend, thou shalt come like a storm, thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy hordes, and many peoples with thee." This is one of the most powerful prophecies in the Bible, and it's regularly promulgated by the evangelical community. You know, the evangelical community, all that word means is Bible-believing, and it has 2 major divisions. One we call dispensationalism. In other words, you read the Bible exactly the way it's written from beginning to end, and you see the long chronology. And the other one is the covenant theologians, of which the largest group is the Reformed folks. They don't read the Bible quite the same way. They impose a few what they call covenants, but they're never mentioned in the Bible. Started in the 1600s, Johannes Cocius, the Netherlands, came up with this idea, and it stuck. It's one of the biggest groups of people on the earth. You know, I was down at one of the Reformed seminaries in Grand Rapids on, I think it was Thursday, we went down. There's a bookstore that I go to in the basement, used bookstore. And these folks are wealthy and big, and thousands and thousands and thousands of them have adopted that theology. It basically denies Israel their rights, and it calls Israel, the Old Testament, church. The Bible never says that, but that's what they say. And they say that there is no future for Israel. Paul says there is in Romans 11, so I'm not sure how you get around that. But when different groups will impose their theologies down on the Bible, when the Bible doesn't comport with their theology, they try and change the text of the Bible to fix the theology, fix the fit, you know, and that's kind of what they do. Well, this prophecy is avoided by them at all costs because they just don't want to deal with it because it's so plain that God is speaking to Israel, not the church, where it's happening, when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and to whom are the players. So within the evangelical dispensational section of evangelicalism, there are a number of views of this. And I'm going to touch on those as we go through this as over the next few weeks. But we're going to carefully look at the text here to see what it says. And I have to say that the English translations, at least the American Standard, the King James, New American Standards, and a couple others, are pretty accurate in translating the words. So it's really another product of why this thing gets misunderstood. The modern translations have a tendency to be, we call dynamic equivalencies, thought for thoughts, like the NIV. And they decide what the thought is, and then they restate it in those ideas. So be that as it may, let's look at the first six verses here. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face toward Gog. And actually, the Hebrew word there is against Gog. Of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and I will turn thee about and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine armies, horses, and horsemen, all of them clothed in full armor, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them handling swords, Persia, Cush, and put with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his hordes, the house of Togarma in the uttermost parts of the north, and all his hordes, even many peoples with thee. So this prophecy is given to Ezekiel, and he's saying, you, Ezekiel, you set your face against this guy. In other words, I don't like you. And the whole first six verses are directed in the first person, God speaking to this G-O-G, Gog, Gog. And it's a prophecy about at least eight nations that are going to invade Israel. And as we go through these two chapters, we're going to see here there are at least these questions that are going to get answered in a general categories. Who are the invaders? And that's what we're going to look at today. Where do they invade? Why are they doing this? What do they expect to achieve? And what are they doing? How are they prepared? In other words, the weaponry. What's going to be used here? And then we'll spend quite a bit of time in our last session about when does this happen. That is the most controversial within the dispensational community. Some have tried to say that it has already happened because they look at the nature of the weapons, horses and helmets and swords and so on. And others have said, well, it happens during the tribulation. At the beginning of the tribulation, others have said, no, this is Armageddon, happens at Armageddon. And I'm going to go through the rationale for all of these different purposes when we get there. And then others have said, well, it happens after the tribulation, because there is a reference to Gog and Magog at the end of the millennial kingdom, a skirmish, not much of a fight, not like this, but it's a skirmish. And so they try and tie it to there. In all instances, they're not using the entire text. The only instance where they use the entire text is before the tribulation. And so I'm going to explain all those. And I have to say that now because we are going to touch on a little bit of the timing today with this terminology, the latter days, which I will introduce right near the end of today's message and pick it up next week. So at the beginning of this prophecy, Ezekiel has got this command. He said, set your face against this guy, Gog, G-O-G. Gog is a term for a leader, an office at the top of something like king, kaiser, whatever. It's a position. It is not a name of somebody, not a formal name. It is a position. And this guy is in direct opposition to God. He's got his own goals, but God, G-O-D, is going to use the evil within this guy to draw him down to Israel. And he uses this term, I'm going to put hooks in his jaws. And, you know, in animal husbandry, it's what they do. You know, they put hooks like a bridle or something, you know, and pull him down. He says, I'm going to pull him south. I'm going to pull him south. So he is the chief prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. So we got this guy here, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And he leads this alliance of a series of nations to Israel in what God says the latter days, okay? And the Bible, it's interesting, God does this repeatedly. He is against sin, but he will use sinful people to achieve his goals. We've seen this when he used these ugly, heinous Assyrians to take out the northern 10 tribes of Israel in 722 BC. And then he judges them for being sinful, even though he uses them. It's hard for us to reconcile this, but in God's providence, he's getting what he needs to get done, and he uses what he has to use to achieve it. And in this one here, as I said, he says, I will put hooks into your cheeks, your jaws, and bring thee forth with all your army. Now, this is an allied invasion of Israel. This is not just one guy with his own army. This is huge. This is going to be a world-scale invasion. World-scale invasion. There are at least 8 nations involved. At least. And in order to understand how these nations are organized and who they are, we've got to look at their names and then go back to Genesis 10 and see where they're originally developed and given. You got Magog, Rosh, Meshach, Tubal, Persia, Put, Comer, Togarma, and others. God always uses the same names throughout Scripture. He doesn't change. He's still calling Israel Jacob, because Jacob's name was changed to Israel. And frequently the Bible says, well, you've seen what I've done in Jacob. He's talking about the nation Israel. Noah and his wife had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And after the ark landed on Mount Ararat, and they dispersed over time, they didn't all disperse right away, which was one of the reasons for the confusion of languages at Babel, forced them to disperse. But they started moving. And the names Magog, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal are all seen in the family tree of one of Noah's sons, Japheth. And the map that I put into your notes shows where Japheth's progeny went. He went to the north and he went to the northwest. He populated Russia, Turkey, Armenia, Europe, primarily Germany, and then the southeastern Balkan states there in Europe. Now, after the flood, these areas primarily in the beginning were between the Black and the Caspian Sea, which today is southern Russia. And it also includes part of Iran, which was ancient Persia. As a matter of fact, it hadn't been all that long since they were touting themselves as Persia. Before, I think it was the 78 or 1979 Khomeini Revolution, Iran was very, very agreeable to the West. The women dressed in Western dress, and they all went to college, and it was a Western nation under the Shah. Well, when Khomeini started his revolution, because he had been hiding out in France for a long time, and something happened where a revolution sparked, and he came back as the leader, and they overthrew the Shah and his family, and they took over. Now it's a despotic Islamic nation that is a worldwide threat. Israel and the United States both consider Iran to be the greatest threat militarily that we have, much more so than this guy in North Korea. Iran has been found to be feeding the terrorists of Hezbollah and others. And I don't know why this hadn't made the national American news, but it made the Israeli news last week that the Israelis bombed a warehouse full of munitions in Syria that the Iranians had placed there. And from what I understand from the Israeli news, it was a massive explosion. And you can only imagine, you know, not only the ordinances that were being dropped, but what they were blowing up. It was a huge explosion. For some reason, it's been blacked out in the American press, Western press. I guess that considering who the Western press are, it sort of makes sense. But you've got these countries that have been formed out of these people groups. Just look at the dynamics here. You get a person who is in the family tree of Noah through his son Japheth. They become tribes. Those tribes become large groups and finally nations. So while these boundaries of where they settled move in and out and depending upon the number of people and so on, and sometimes the names change, Persia to Iran. Even back in the early 70s, Iran was viewed as the Persian and empire with the peacock king. That was the Shah. They still called it Persia half the time. But now nobody knows what Persia is unless you look it up in a history book, because I don't think they're even talking about that anymore. Well, you've got these countries now that have modern names, that were families, and you've got these names that also became cities. Meshach, Tubal became cities that are now Moscow and Tobolsk. Those were family names, and they're in the Urals in Siberia. Rosh is what is now the northern part of Russia, and Rosh is a Hebrew word that means head, top, above, something like that. And that map shows exactly where these people went after the flood. And Japheth's migration is into the between the Black Seas, the Caspian Seas, into what southern Russia is called the Russian Steppes, and into northwest direction, which would be southeastern Europe. Modern-day Turkey and Armenia, just to the east of that, was a settling spot for a lot of the Japhethites. And God highlights Turkey and southern Russia to emphasize where these invaders are going to come from. And again, he uses these ancient names. We see these ancient names from Genesis 10 showing where they went. And I put it in graphic form in two different graphs besides the map to help us see in a chart-like manner where these folks are and where they're going to come from. The geographic region lets us see how these forces are going to organize around this guy, Gog, from the north. And every one of these groups has persecuted the Jews. Every one of them. The worst one's been Germany. We know what they did. They slaughtered in the Holocaust there 5 or 6 million, 7 million, whatever it is. Millions in a genocide. The Russians have not been very favorable to the Jews either, at all. So again, let's look at this genealogy chart here of Noah and Japheth. And these are the guys that populated what was modern Russia. And Magog, Meshach, and Tubal were located between the Black and the Caspian Seas. And these cities bear the names Moscow, the capital, and Tobolsk. And Rosh, again, means top or head. And these cover the northern territories. And that's what's important for us to get here, the northern territories, because a straight line, you know, the text even says these are come from the uttermost parts of the north. Well, if you look at Jerusalem on the map, and almost straight up is Moscow, almost straight up. This is repeated in 38:15 and then 39:2. So you got this straight line here, and it's telling you who these people are. We know where they migrated. We know what the countries are. We know that somebody named Gog from the uttermost parts of Russia is going to be the leader. And, you know, the rabbinic Jewish scholars have been saying this for 900 years. One of the Jewish commentaries that I look at periodically is called by Rabbi Moshe Eisenman, says the Gainim had a tradition that these controls were indeed located in Russia. One tradition passed down from the Vilna Gaon states, when the Russian Navy passed through the Bosphorus on the way to the Dardanelles, it's time to put on Sabbath clothes in anticipation of the coming of the Messiah. Now, the Gaonim, or the Gaon, if you will, were a couple of Jewish yeshivas, that's the Jewish seminaries, that were in Babylon. And remember now, the Jews were in the south, Judah, were carted off to Babylon, and we've been talking about this throughout this book. Ezekiel warns and warns and warns. It happens, in 586... And they were there 70 years, and then the Babylonians were conquered by the Persians, and the Persians said, hey, we got no beef with you guys, go on back. Well, people had developed lives there, and they'd been there for several generations. Go back to what? They didn't know that. They knew Babylon. And the Persian king was favorable to them and letting them stay, so they lived there. There was only about 50,000 of them went back. We see that in Haggai and Zechariah. But most of them stayed, and they developed these yeshivas, and they had a huge culture there. Well, the Gaonic period lasted about 450 years, from 589 to 1038, And they had a number of gaons, if you will, which is the top guy, the top rabbi, the teacher. And they were considered the final authority on halachic, or the practice of Judaism and the teachings. There were more than 80 of these guys during this period. And the whole power of all the Bible teaching in the medieval period was focused on these guys. So they are very authoritative. They looked at this prophecy and they knew exactly what it was. They knew exactly what it was. And they didn't have any qualms at all. But here today you hear Bible elucidators say, well, we don't know these things and we don't know that. And well, look what the Bible tells us. You know, Genesis 10 tells us who they are. Where did they migrate to? But, you know, people don't want to pay attention to the Old Testament today, so they miss a lot of these activities. The Jews in these yeshivas back in Babylon thought there were, because they rejected Jesus, they just rejected him. And that's interesting to see this, because they didn't reject him with evidence, they just flat out rejected him. You know, I've heard people do this with other things. Well, I'm not going to believe that. Well, wait, let's talk. No, I'm just not going to believe it. And they stop any information from coming in, regardless of whether it's factual, true, there's evidence, they don't care. Well, that's what these guys did about Jesus. And it helps to see in Luke 19 that Jesus said, because you've rejected me, I'm going to make this real hard for you to come to me. Well, what these guys, these Gaonim, what they said was very authoritative. And they believed there were two messiahs. And it's interesting is because in the book of Luke, we got one genealogy of Jesus. And the book of Matthew, we got another. And they, one goes down to Mary and one goes down to Joseph, his stepfather, if you will. They taught there was going to be two messiahs. One was going to be killed, and the other one was going to run the messianic kingdom. It's the same Jesus. But they got that part right. They got that part right. So these guys were authoritative, and they knew exactly what this prophecy was and who the participants were. Russia is the leader of the invasion of Israel. And she's part of the Confederacy too, but more importantly, Gog, G-O-G, is coming out of that country as the leader of this Confederacy. Persia, present-day Iran, we know that they used to be pro-Israel and pro-United States, but not anymore. My goodness, somebody even made a movie recently about the capture of the people that were in the embassy, the American embassy there. How many days did they hold them? I remember listening to Ted Koppel on, I think it was Channel 7 at night, day number 160, day number. And Jimmy Carter, the president at the time, he couldn't do anything. He was ineffective. And as soon as Reagan got in office, they knew better than to deal with him because they released him. So all it takes is a strong leader that does what he says he's going to do, and the other people just fall by the side. They fall by the side. Well, hopefully that's what's happening today. We'll see, and history will bear out hopefully that. The United States and Israel both consider Iran to be an extremely dangerous country with extremely dangerous people. Now, another nation here is called Cush. And in the Bible, there's two of these. There's one in Mesopotamia, but it only appears once in Genesis 2:13 because most of the references are to Ethiopia. So you have to weigh this and see which of these are we talking about here. And at the strong sense here of elucidation, if you will, is Ethiopia. And some people want to use current events to try and say it's Mesopotamia because a lot of people will look at what they see in the Bible, try and find it in the newspaper, or go backwards, which is, we call it newspaper exegesis. You don't do that. You don't look at what happens today in the news and then go back to the Bible and say, well, that's this or that's this. It's very hard to do that and very difficult. The other way, yes, you get the Bible's teaching and you know that, and then you go look to see if it matches up. That sort of makes more sense. So the Bible narrative gives us the names of all of these things. Put is mentioned here. It's not Libya. Some people like to say it's Libya, but it's Somalia. And Somalia borders Ethiopia. And it's followed by Gomer in the text here. And that's what the Vilna Gaon said too. Gomer is Germany. Now, the Midrash, a Midrash is like a Jewish commentary. You know, we would say blog today. Oh, he wrote a blog, he wrote an article. Well, they would say he wrote a Midrash on that. And they call Gomer Germania. The Talmud, which was written during the period of the capture of Babylon, the Talmud also calls Germany Gomer. And the last name here is Togarma, which is present-day Armenia. It's on the east side of Turkey. And in verse 6 adds the phrase, many peoples with you. It can either be more other countries, which is probable, or more other people than just the ones named within those groups. So I'm not sure. I have said it. It looks like it could be more people within those countries, but I'm not sure. I can't be dogmatic about that. The who, then, is Russia, the allied states of Iran, Ethiopia, Somalia, Germany, Armenia, and eastern Turkey. And these guys are all located north and south of Israel and in the southwest of Israel, but the controlling country is Russia. Russia. And the invasion comes from the north. So they're going to congregate someplace and they invade from the north. And general geography shows us where they were. And again, the boundaries can change somewhat over time, as they do, with different wars and treaties and so on. But the general regions are intact. And again, you know, this Orthodox Jewish commentary makes one other observation here about Magog and Gutia. Here, Yerushalayim Megillah, that is Jerusalem. The writing, the Megillah, is another kind of a commentary that they write. It renders Magog as Gutia or Guta. The Goths, a group of nomadic tribes who destroyed the Scythians, made their home in Scythian territory. And I put a map of where Scythia was in the Russian steppes north of the ancient nation of Parthia, which we don't hear much about. And the text goes on there, and that Megillah is considering that the Goths were a Germanic people. The identification of Magog's descendants as the Goths, in accordance with Targum Yonasan, and that's another kind of a writing, in Genesis 10:2, which renders Magog as Germania, which in Bereshit Rabbah is given as Germania. So again, another Bereshit Rabbah, another set of commentaries, and they describe Magog as Germania. So you got all these different writings describing the Goths here, Magog, as Germany. And the Germans have been at war with just about everybody forever. It's interesting. Even, you know, if you've ever read Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbon starts out with talking about the first emperor he's talking about here is at the end of the first century. It's Commodus. that he's German. And a very, very strong guy, very warlike. Look at the map there of Scythia. The Scythians were an extremely powerful and evil, evil empire. Evil. And the Apostle Paul giving us the degree and the inclusion of salvation to everybody on this earth that wants it. He says even a Scythian can get saved. Even the grace of God extends to the Scythians. And they were so terrible that he was, you know, now we don't know who the Scythians are today because it's not something that's commonly discussed, and it's a country that's been gone, or nomadic tribes, for a long time. And they're just to the north of Parthia. Parthia is another ancient nation that was as powerful as the Roman Empire. And they butted up against the Roman Empire in Syria, which is just north of Israel. And there was always tension between the Romans and the Parthians. As a matter of fact, Herod the Great was constantly in fear that there was going to be an outbreak because he had decided that his fortune was with the Romans and he was going to hang his hat on an alliance with them and not the Parthians. So he kept worried, man. And if you remember some of the discussion we've had about who the Magi were, well, they came from the Parthian region into Jerusalem, and they wanted to know, where is the king of the Jews? They'd seen his star. And Herod just went, uh-oh. You know, I'm allied with the Romans, and here come these Parthians, and, you know, what's going to happen? Parthia was a huge, huge, powerful group. Not anymore. What is really interesting about this is seemingly God's vengeance on these nations that have persecuted the Jews. Genesis 12:3 through 12:6, the beginning of the Abrahamic covenant, starts out with, I'm going to bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you. You know, all of these nations have persecuted the Jews, every one of them. From 1721 on, the official doctrine of Imperial Russia was anti-Jewish. Yeah, it was official. It wasn't even something that they just kind of did. It was, no, this is the official stance. We're doing this. Russia has never been, as a result of this, a healthy country with economic freedom and safety for everybody. It is the country where communism was first implemented in the Bolshevik Revolution. I mean, they have had massive problems. They've been persecuting the Jews for a long time. And God has said, you persecute the Jews, I'm not going to show you any favor. One of the things I worry about with our country, if we ever actively divorce ourselves from helping Israel, this country will be over. I mean, God will break us in a heartbeat. And we have helped them. We have given them armaments. We've sold armaments to them, economically helped them. The Tsar established in the mid-1700s a place called the Pale of Settlement. And it was in Western Russia, in the Ukraine, and off into Poland. And what they did was they took all the Jews and they forced them over there. Just like Hitler forced all the Jews into the ghettos in Warsaw. The Russians did the same thing. They forced all the Jews into the Pale of Settlement. And they were supposed to remain there unless they had special permission. So you get to around 1786, and you got Catherine the Great. So she then orders all the Jews, not just into the Pale, but she pushes them farther out into the Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarusia, Crimea, and other parts of Poland that weren't included in the first Pale. So these guys get massively pushed over there. I mean, I got this picture in my mind of pictures I've seen of, war-torn countries where these people are in caravans and horses with their goods and their clothes, their whole, everything they have is on their backs and on the backs of these animals, and they're moving out. That's what they did to them. That's what they did to them. They were expelled from Moscow and St. Petersburg and the big cities. And then they expelled them from the Pale. They pushed them out of there. They just wanted to destroy God's people. It's a satanic action to be anti-Semitic. Then they forced them to live in these little teeny towns, these little teeny villages called shtetls. And the word shtetl is a Yiddish term that just means a small town or a small village. Yiddish is a combination of Hebrew and German mixed together. And it was part of the Ashkenazi Jewish folks that lived in Europe that were primarily destroyed in the Holocaust. And then they started to squeeze them out of there and persecute them. And it eventually killed off the shtetls. But the death of the shtetls kind of ended with the Holocaust. And with the Holocaust, you get now world sympathy and the United Nations, as we know, in the fall of 1947, voted to let the Jews have a homeland, a country, which they have now. So let's move on. We know who these people are. There's one factor here. This Gog, G-O-G, is well known to be somebody from Russia, as we can see from the text here. And I just want to bring out, we don't know who it is, by the way. We don't know who it is. Like, people are always trying to figure out who the Antichrist is. It stopped even trying, you know, because all these predictions that people have made don't even comport with the Bible. They're not even close. Like, I hear people saying today that this son-in-law of our president is probably the Antichrist. Where did you get that? My goodness. Yeah, you look at Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and it shows that there's a 10-division confederacy of this world out of which the Antichrist comes. And in Daniel 7, he's the 11th horn that comes out of this last form imperialism of the world government. We haven't broken up into 10 regions yet, but you know, people don't read the Bible. They don't care. They don't care, you know. Don't confuse me with the facts. I got my mind made up that this is what I'm going to tell you. Well, it's the same thing with Gog, G-O-G. We don't know who he is. We just know he's a leader. A lot of people were talking about maybe 20 years ago, Vladimir Zhirinovsky. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he was a notoriously evil Jew hater, hated the Jews. Matter of fact, he wrote a book, Last Dash to the South, where he wanted to go down and attack Israel. So the idea of doing this is not just in the text. They have that idea already. It's alive up there. Now, he tried to run for the presidency, and he never made it. He did get elected to their parliament, though. And I don't know if he's still in the parliament. And he was in... They've got a party there that he was part of that was rabid anti-Semitic. So the ideas are there in the political arena already on our earth, not just here. We get to see people doing this. So let's look at last few verses here. Be thou prepared, yea, prepare thyself, thou and all thy companies that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. After many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. Thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, that is gathered out of many peoples upon the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste, but it is brought forth out of the peoples, and they shall dwell securely, all of them. And thou shalt ascend, thou shalt come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy hordes and many peoples with thee. So it's talking here again about the invasion. It's going to take place on these mountains of Israel. And there's a mountain chain right down the middle of Israel from north to south. Gog is the leader. And it takes place in the land of Israel, the land of Israel, and the mountains of Israel. And he describes the massiveness of this invasion. And the massiveness is like a storm cloud covering the land. This shows us that there has to be a state of Israel there. I mean, there wasn't anybody there. We've seen the quotes from Mark Twain. Nobody here. Nobody here. It couldn't have happened in the past. And I've told you that Maimonides, the Jewish philosopher, rabbi, teacher, he left Spain because of persecution around 1200, late 1100s, and he wanted to go to Israel, and he went to Israel. Man, nobody's here. This place is desolate. Went to Jerusalem, and he couldn't stand being there, so he went over to Egypt. No, this describes modern-day Israel. Modern-day Israel. And it describes Israel being back in the land after armed conflicts. And it says that they are there in unbelief. Now, it doesn't use those words, but the words it does use is they become believers. They become believers of God. And you look at Israel today, the last thing they want to talk about is God. I mean, they have one of the biggest homosexual parades in the world in Tel Aviv. They're way, way out in left field in terms of actually confessing God. And we know they're there in unbelief, but they're back according to the prophecies in Ezekiel 37, Ezekiel 20, Ezekiel 22. And they will turn to God at the end of the tribulation. They will turn to him. Now, verse 8 describes being first a land brought back from the sword. They declared independence, and immediately all these Arab nations attacked them, and they fought them all off with World War I weapons that were given to them by the Czechoslovakians. Two, it's a land gathered out of many peoples, and we know from the Zionist movement, as we went through Ezekiel 37, we saw the Zionist movement was pulling people from around the world that were Jewish back to Israel, different countries. World War I brought even more of them back under the British mandate when the Ottoman Turks were defeated and the United Nations realigned, or not the United Nations, it was the League of Nations at that time. They realigned the boundaries of Europe and the Middle East. Third, this is a land with mountains and that have been a continual waste. We have looked at the Valley of Jezreel and seen what goes on next to those mountains. I mean, how it's come back. The kibbutzim movement has just established a wonderful amount of produce coming from those areas. And it was a continual waste. Think back to the comments that Mark Twain made. Fourth, it's a land that is brought forth out of the peoples. So Ezekiel's not describing any land of Israel that from ancient times. This he's describing today. And we know that, as I said, beginning of the 19th century, about middle of the 19th century, towards the end even better, is when the Zionists started bringing people back. The settlements, the waste, everything has been brought back to a greater level of milk and honey than it's ever had. The latter days, which is what we will touch on in our next session, is a specific reference to the time starting with the First World War. And I'm going to go over that in detail in our next session. Jesus talked about the latter days, and he used Jewish idiomatic phrases, Hebrew idiomatic phrases, to describe what they are. And I'll go over those in detail in our next session, and we'll talk about how that pertains to the 20th century and beyond, and how does this prophecy fit into those. But there's a lot more characteristics as well of this prophecy, the weaponry and what the names for the weapons are today, the Hebrew uses of generic terms and so on. I mean, this is a prophecy that has incredible import for world political events, especially after it happens. It's going to have a unifying effect between the Eastern nation bloc, which is the communists and the Muslim nations, and the Western democracies. So this is something to really pay attention to, because this is something for our time. Something for our time. But let us pray.